Hello, my name is Dr. Vanessa Kimball, and I am a baker. But I'm also someone who has studied and researched the impact of bread on our health for many years. I run the Sourdough School in Northamptonshire, and my specialism is bread and the gut microbiome and the impact on our mental health. But I'm also trained as a nutrigenetic practitioner, meaning I look at the way that bread impacts people according to their genetics. It helps me to personalise bread. And in this podcast, I'm going to be chatting to someone who I hope you are going to find as interesting as I did. What I'd love is for you to listen and think about the bread that you bake, eat, and share with your family. Because bread is a staple, it's our most basic food, and I believe it is the foundation to good health.
Resident scientist at the fermentation lab at NOMA. I also am head of research for MAD, our food think tank. Nonprofit.
That's such a cool thing to do. No, I'm just totally blown away by that. Okay, so. Oh, it's so warm in
it's
here.
Very warm. Yes. Oh, it is very warm.
And that smell.
Yes. It's a bit of funk. It's a nice funk, though. But this is our garum room. So, in these shipping containers here in the parking lot of NOMA, we have 7 different temperature and humidity controlled rooms that all are responsible for some different style of ferment that we produce for the restaurant. This room is the hot room. It's kept at about 60 degrees Celsius, where we basically make our own fish sauces, but these are garums, garum being the old Indo-European or Roman, Greco-Roman name for this style of protein-based ferment. So garums in ancient Roman times were made from fish harvested from the Mediterranean that they would grind or mash up with their innards intact, and all those digestive enzymes within the fish would start breaking down the fish's proteins themselves, and you'd mix it with salt, and over the course of months as it sat in limestone vats, you would end up with this delicious stinky sauce that you could dilute, and it would be very nutritious, you could cook with, etc., etc. So we make our own here because they are very powerful culinary tools, as anyone who's been to Southeast Asia knows. And we make them with Danish ingredients because there's nothing really about the process that isn't cooking. And we kind of take this inspiration from elsewhere on Earth and apply it to our little subset of Scandinavian products to make really amazing flavors. So we have things like bee pollen, fermenting with salt. We have squid garum. Those are all the leftovers from the squid that we produced last year. Scallop garum, mahogany clams. These seafood ferments would generally be made from, you know, the offcuts after cleaning our scallops ourselves. We would take all the roe and, you know, the mouth and the gills. Same thing with the mahogany clams. Beef and pork garum we would make from either the scraps that we produce ourselves or we would buy in ground beef, Danish beef, and do that. We have roasted chicken wing here. And then a big staple of this restaurant is the grasshopper garum, which we make from insects, and we combine it with a bit of moth larva as well, and that's probably one of the tastiest things that we produce in the lab. And we use it in the restaurant kind of like the catch-all, fix-all. You know, if we have something, we're like, what does this need? You'll probably find some grasshopper garum in it.
How on earth did you come up with the idea of grasshopper garum?
Well, I think that had a lot to do with the Nordic Food Lab, which is something that was started here at Restaurant NOMA to push forward the exploration process. And it was started to be an independent resource that would, you know, do its own research, would bring in minds from all over the world, and delve much deeper into the Nordic region and the products available.
It was like 2008, 2009 yeah. That was started.
Ariel started as an intern.
Visiting scientist.
Visiting scientist.
Excuse me. Yeah, no, that's actually how I met Lars. He was head of R&D at the Nordic Food Lab around 2012, and I came during my PhD to work on some fermentation and flavor projects, and after he came back to Noma and I graduated, I followed him. So Grasshopper Garum is kind of his invention. Kind of coming from like the parallel track of working with some Asian style fermentations like miso and soy sauce, having products like koji around, which I guess we'll show.
We'll see in a second. Yeah.
Soon, and also having grasshoppers, other insects around at the lab to kind of explore their culinary possibilities. And so, you know, koji is excellent at breaking down proteins. Grasshoppers are an excellent source of protein. So if you put them both together, you get something completely new, but also referencing this very, very old process and old flavors. So
what's the percentage of kind of rice koji to grasshopper?
We actually use barley koji because barley grows a bit better than rice. In
okay,
Scandinavia.
That makes, sorry, that makes sense.
Yeah,
can
yeah.
You say that again?
No, sorry. Well, I mean, with a lot of these things, we take a process that's used elsewhere and then apply it to local ingredients. So rather than rice koji, we'll make barley koji from biodynamic Danish barley. The grasshoppers, I think, are Danish grasshoppers too. But this, it's like 10% koji to like 60% grasshoppers, 10% salt, and so the rest is water.
How long does it take?
About 10 weeks.
And how long do you keep it for then?
As long as we need. It's extremely stable.
Yeah.
So that's like 15 liters in there. So how long
yeah.
will that last for the restaurant? I mean, how often are you making
it? We're a busy restaurant, I would say. At this pace we've been going through, maybe like a bucket like this in maybe about a month and a half to 2 months. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we are, you know, it's only a 45-seat dining room, but we do manage to feed a lot of people every week, probably in the neighborhood of 500 or more. 500 to 600 people come
yeah.
through these stores every week.
The smell in here is extraordinary. I don't say that lightly, but there is that Asian base.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It's got that kind of fish kind of depth to it, but there's something kind of mushroomy about it.
It's probably the koji.
Could be the koji.
Yeah, no, but it absolutely is all of those flavors. I mean, it gets inside you, and it's you know, a lot of people kind of get taken aback by it, but for cooks, this is something, it's a very delicious smell, because this is, like, the longer you cook and the longer you work with flavors, what you realize is just like an essence of deliciousness. You know, you wouldn't want to drink a cup of fish sauce from Thailand, but at the same time you wouldn't want to make a curry without it.
It's kind of fun because in Vietnam I could smell this fermenting fish and kind of follow my nose, and almost at the time, it's about 7 or 8 years ago, was horrified and fascinated all at the same time, because it was so, the word, well, there were, I don't think there were any hygiene considerations. It was just fermenting in a vat by the side of the fish, and you could smell it from home. I was like, and yeah, no, it's, this is much, I mean, it's incredible, you know, that fermentation kind of sees off a lot of the pests, you know, a lot of the unwelcome microbiome. It has its own kind of,
yeah.
What's the word I'm looking for? It has its own kind of rules to who can come in and who can't come in, doesn't it?
Mm.
Is that something that you do as part of your studies? Do you look at kind of what's going on inside?
Well, I mean, like, pretty much the design of each of these rooms is around creating, like, a particular environment. So we read up a lot about, like, both what makes particular microbes happy, but also maybe how to, like, optimize certain parts of their metabolism, or emphasize, like, some strains over others, and then, like, tailor the environment so that that happens. So it's kind of, like, knowing that gives you this kind of, like, soft power type of control over what you're fermenting, which I think gives you a potential for a lot more, like, interesting flavors in the end than if you were being, like, very, controlling much more through, like, inoculation and, pasteurization and stuff like that.
So you've got some spoons there.
Yeah. Would you like to, This is a
I like the
one.
Mackerel.
Me too. This guy's young, so he hasn't been around for too long. It's only... What were you? Just over 2 weeks right now? So this is mackerel. Danish mackerel, which is in season right now, that I ground without the guts. Because while this is a very traditional way, or would be a traditional way, to make garum by combining all the intestines and all those juices in there, sometimes you do want just cleaner flavors.
That's an incredible looking... it's like a... That sounds very silly, but it almost looks like a lentil stew.
Kind of does.
Yeah.
Kind of does.
Barley.
It doesn't taste like it.
No. No. It's kind of weird because the smell has almost like that. You can smell mackerel and you can smell fishiness, and then there's almost like a biscuit smell at the back of it. Can you smell that kind of like almost sort of slightly burnt shortbread? Like
well,
smell?
So like the. Enzymes that go into, from the koji that go into all of these garums, you're freeing a lot of sugars from starches, like in the barley, you're freeing a lot of amino acids from proteins. And those are the building blocks for the Maillard reaction, which you might know as browning in meat or bread or some other thing like that. So whereas you'd usually see that, like if you're searing a piece of beef at a very high temperature, keeping it in this environment at 60 degrees Celsius, it takes a lot longer, but those same reactions are happening. So you do get these exactly the same processes as you get in burning a biscuit.
That's very interesting, because as you were telling me that, I was tasting this, and the complexity of flavours in there, and the range is... There's sweet, there's salty, there's sour. Meat, there's that meaty kind of smell. Funnily enough, it didn't taste fishy. In fact, it didn't. Now there's a little bit of that kind of mackerel. But that is a range of about five or six flavours all happening at the same time. That's incredible.
Yeah?
Not what I was expecting. Seriously.
Well, happy to pleasantly surprise you.
Okay, and I'll get you just a little bit of liquid out of the grasshopper as well.
So can I have a little look in there as well?
Yeah, so...
Okay,
the same
so there's no
on.
Sort of like, you know, what are they called? Wings and...
Well,
and
they're
all been ground up.
Blended in there.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can just take a little bit of that liquid.
You might find a leg.
Smells like a bakery.
There's a sweetness to the grasshopper garum. There really is.
Oh, it's crunchy, a little crunchy. That's quite a powerful flavour. And there's a lot of umami in there.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, a little bit of smokiness, that sounds very strange, but I can... Beef? This sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? I wasn't expecting it. Almost like, you know, in England we have, like a beef,
Like bovril?
Yeah.
There's
bovrilliness in it.
Yeah.
We definitely exist in that world.
Yeah, that's
flavor domain.
Yeah,
it's an incredibly base flavor, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's going to sit, and everything's going to sit on top of that.
Yeah,
it's going to provide sort of the foundation of almost anything that you're baking. Mm. That's a real privilege to have that, and you know, never ever eat grasshopper before. Wow, that's incredible.
Preparing for 2050.
When we run out of everything else.
Just out of interest, can I try?
Oh, that's pretty special.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking the bee pollen is has a real.
So the fun thing about this room is that these are protein based ferments. You know,
bee pollen is very rich in protein.
Trying to make garums out of.
Yeah.
Trying to make garums out of vegetables doesn't really work so well. You kind of get this like mashed up, mulched grass flavor. It doesn't carry through.
Or like vegetable stock cube.
Yeah, but bee pollen is oddly enough always almost up to 60% protein, depending on the hive. And you're basically eating, you know, the best part of the flower, the most floral part, the thing that the bees go after, or inadvertently so.
Okay, if you left the room, I could probably eat half that pot while you were...
Well, that you would owe us a lot of money, because it don't come cheap.
Seriously, that is so delicious. Yeah. It's kind of got kind of burnt butterscotch, and really kind of caramelly tones to it. Sweet, it's really... And malt.
Yeah.
Mm. It tastes malty.
Yeah. And on top of all that, it has this floralness, because you are eating flowers.
You can leave now. Yeah, no, I'm totally sold on that. I walked in and I was a little bit nervous, if I'm truthful. I wasn't expecting to like them.
Oh, there you go. We're doing our job. But I have to introduce you to Rasmus. So this is our
baby. Hi, Rasmus. How are you?
I'm good.
If you enjoyed listening to that podcast as much as I enjoyed chatting with my guests, then you might like to find out a little bit more about what I do. Well, I teach courses both online and in person at thesourdoughschool.com. I also write regularly for sourdough.co.uk, and I have a couple of Instagram accounts that you might like to follow: Sourdough School, Sourdough Club. Oh, and I have a personal one, Vanessa Kimball. I really do love to hear people's thoughts and feedback about, well, the books I write, the podcast, the features, or if you have any questions, don't hesitate to get in touch. Thank you for listening.